dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go,
you're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Imagine a small rural town near a lake in a beautiful but economically depressed area filled with tree-covered hills, streams, wineries, farms, and dairies. A place like home. It's not Ovid or Trumansburg or Union Springs, but it could be. Tonight we're going to hear about the town of Oxford in Warren County in rural northwest New Jersey and how it is being poisoned to death by a toxic waste incinerator forced on the town against its will. We will hear how the town of Oxford became a sacrifice zone. Most significantly, the governor of New Jersey, Christine Whitman, on whose watch this happened, has been named to head the Environmental Protection Agency under the Prophet's Uber Alles regime of G.W. Bush. I'm from Southern California and have seen firsthand how greed, otherwise known as economic development, can turn a beautiful land into a hellhole, how a land of orange groves can be transformed into a sprawl of housing tracts, strip malls, freeways, traffic jams, and smog. And for those places not deemed eligible for that sort of development, another fate looms, to be their trash can. Could we here suffer the same fate as Oxford? Well, consider the people that brought us the Guardian Glass Factory and want to bring us the Geneva Ag Biotech Park. Consider that the landfill in Waterloo is now taking garbage from Vermont. Consider that the old Army Depot, now a prison, in Romulus is filled with toxic hotspots, and that similar toxic and radioactive sites have been found in the Ithaca area, leaching into the lake. Silent, invisible killers. Just look at Syracuse. Beautiful Onondaga Lake, poisoned by corporations that take their profits and then, with the help of the U.S. government, flee to foreign climes where they can pay workers almost nothing and poison and destroy their lands, too. Tonight we're going to hear part of a five-part documentary, Oxford, New Jersey, Anatomy of a Sacrifice Zone. We'll conclude the documentary next week, as it's longer than the time allowed. We encourage you to tape this program and distribute the information to others in the community. We plan in the coming months to bring to this program examples of environmentally sound options of economic development and to discuss how we, the people, can take matters into our own hands to implement them, since those in control of government at almost all levels are either too short-sighted, unimaginative, greedy, or corrupt to help us.
The following is a special presentation of Coyote Nation Press.
The greenhouse, the lady there just passed away with throat cancer. The house right next door, he has prostate cancer. He's had it for the past year. Here where I live, I was just diagnosed in June with cancer of the cervix. Right next door, the lady passed away with cancer of the uterus. Right next door to her, this man died of lung cancer. When they found it, it had gone all through his body. There was nothing he can do. He was gone like in 6 months from the time they found it until he passed away. Right across the street, this man had lung cancer. He died about a year after this man here on this side of the street.
little town of Oxford in Warren County is located in a pastoral section of rural northwest New Jersey. This is not the New Jersey of oil refineries, sludge dumps, and toxic rivers, but of gently rolling landscapes dotted with farms, historic homes, and villages. It is a secluded corner of the state where trees and wildlife still outnumber people. But if Oxford, New Jersey is so nice, why are so many people getting sick? Oxford tragically illustrates the frightening cost of fouling our own nest. As the world's population grows, the price of our overconsumptive lifestyles becomes clear in places like Oxford. Sacrificing poor, politically weak communities has a long tradition. In Oxford, that tradition goes back to the turn of the last century and continues today, as Oxford is condemned to serve as the county's toilet far into the next century. As we continue to produce more garbage, more wastewater, more toxic byproducts without a safe place to put the residue, the people of Oxford and other poor communities continue to pay the price. But why, when it comes to the health of our communities, our children, our food, our air and our water, would we hesitate to ask at what price? And why would elected officials charged with protecting the public turn a blind eye not only to the health risks, but to their civic and moral responsibilities as well? The story of Oxford needs to be told because we all need to understand the history of injustice. We all need to understand the price, in human terms, that we are being asked to pay by the corporate transnationals who are handing us the bill. Rural Warren County now has the highest rate of cancer in New Jersey, and the cancer rate in Oxford is more than twice that. In the explosion of poisons now infiltrating our communities, the scenic little town of Oxford is ground zero. Now the bill is coming due, in this first-class, worst-case scenario. Part 1. A History of Injustice. At the turn of the century, mining was the largest industry in Oxford. Oxford's rich ore and lime deposits, combined with its proximity to major rail lines and canals, enticed industrialists to the country. Noted inventor and entrepreneur Thomas Edison operated a limestone quarry in Oxford. Later, during the Second World War, Charles Revson, founder of the Revlon Cosmetic Company, reportedly had a hand in the manufacture of bombs, grenades, and flares at a local munitions factory called the Vorset. Most of the labor used in the mines was provided by immigrants. Agents for the mine owners would travel to Ellis Island to handpick the youngest and strongest men. They would bring them back to Oxford, rent them company houses, and give them credit at company stores. The shackles used on these immigrants were as strong as the iron they wrought from the earth. Tempered only with sweat and blood, these shackles were designed to keep this cheap labor force captive and powerless. Working the iron mines and foundries took a heavy toll on the health of the European immigrants. No protective gear was issued, no pensions were paid, or medical care provided. Outbreaks of influenza and tuberculosis were common among the workers. Steve Petersack is 84 years old. He lived in Oxford as a young boy and returned after retirement. He now lives in a former company house, just a few steps from his childhood home. He remembers the poverty and the damage inflicted on his father's lungs by the mines.
My father had worked in the ore kilns. That's before I was born. He worked in the ore kilns. You know, they had the mines, and the ore kilns not far away up here in Jonestown, where Hillside Cemetery is. Do you know where that is? Well, right, you go right on around, it's behind it. That was the ore kilns. And that's when my dad used to wheel in the wheelbarrow with the iron they took out of the mines, and he wheeled this up into the kilns and dumped it in the kilns. And he's all that fumes he was coming out, sulfur, burning the sulfur off. And he was breathing that. No safety features in days, just back in the early 1900s. And for miles around there, nothing would grow. Nothing. No trees, just fields and low grass. And people were breathing it all the way around there.
Steve remembers when his father, unable to work and suffering from tuberculosis, returned home unexpectedly from a sanatorium in Pennsylvania.
That's when he got sick, when he worked on a section gang on the railroad. He started getting real sick. He was starting to cough. He couldn't stop coughing. So then he went to the sanatorium. They said he had consumption at that time. That's what they call it, consumption. And what he was doing, he's spitting stuff up with green lumps and everything. Mm. Oh, I'll never forget it. Anyway, they took him to a sanatorium in Pennsylvania called in Whitehaven. I was when we were kids, we used to hitchhike to Washington and go to the movies, the theater. Mm-hmm. They had one in Knoxville when I was real young, and they tore that down. That's another story. But we used to hitchhike. Four or five kids used to hitchhike to Washington. And people know us, they'd pick us up. You know, friends of ours had cars. They'd pick us up. And sometimes we'd hitchhike on the way back when the guys were coming back from their girlfriends in Phillipsburg or Washington or whatever. And they knew it, so they'd pick us all up. So three or four of us would get in the car. There was a man walking in, oh, about 2 miles from here, walking on the road. And Pat Carson was driving the car. He said, well, we got a car full now. I don't think we can pick him up. So I said, okay, so nothing. So we come on home. Mm-hmm. A half hour later, a knock come on the door. I lit up there. And here was my father. Walked in the door. He walked all the way from the sanatorium home. He didn't want to stay there, so he walked home. He said, we can't hold you. He had no ride. He walked all the way home. And that was him walking. Didn't walk right. We went right on by him. Never picked him up. I never forget that. But anyway.
Vorset was a munitions complex erected at the start of World War II and demolished shortly after the conclusion of the war. When the war was over, heavy machinery was brought in, huge holes were dug, and the war-making contents of five buildings were buried. Alice McNulty is also a lifelong resident of Oxford. Alice worked in the Vorset during the war.
I'm a resident of Warren Haven, Oxford, New Jersey, for the elderly, and I am 90 years old. I used to work at the Vorset. I worked in the Black Powder, not every day, but once in a great while. It was dangerous, but they said I was doing a good job, and that's why I was put in there so much. I worked there, and then I worked on a line with other girls. I forgot the line. I'm 90 years old, so don't push me. We worked at the Black Powder, and then it was, you have been very careful. I wore a pair of cloth boots over my regular shoes. And I think I wore an apron, a cloth apron, heavy cloth apron. And they told me when I went in there that be careful, even my hair was covered. And one spark of this would be bad. That's why I was covered with the shoes and the hair bit.
Lieutenant Colonel Nancy Burke, a public information officer at the Pentagon, could find no record of the Vorset. Michael Music, the military specialist at the National Archives in Washington, D.C., also could find no trace of the Vorset. And now, more than 50 years later, the property sits idle. The only thing we know for certain is that people in Oxford are getting sick. Concerned about the prevalence of cancer in Oxford, Peggy Burns asked freeholder Susan Dickey to investigate what was buried in the fields behind her house.
Find out what the hell's going on. Why didn't they check this out years ago? People moving in with little kids, they know the incinerator's out here, they know the old Vorset site's out here, they know the dye works is running. Nobody says anything about nothing. These people move in, they don't tell them this stuff is buried out in the ground or this waste is running out in the fields. Oh yeah, it's a nice quiet town, move on in. Next thing you know, these kids are getting sick. Look at the Pinko kids up there. They did nothing to nobody. Why do they have to suffer? Because somebody's going to make money? That's not right. Seems the more money they make, put it in. We don't care. It's not their kids, so why do they care? It's not their families. Who's getting this money where it's coming in? Oh, we're going to put this in. This is going to bring your taxes down. They bring the incinerator and stuff in. Taxes go up. People get sick and die. So what's going to happen? For money? I hope they're doing something good with it. They sure ain't doing it for this town. They bring it in. Our people get sick and die. Their wallets get big and fat. It's about time. I talked to Susan Dickey, and I told her something she was going to investigate. This was on a Friday afternoon. Everything is closed on a weekend. About time she got in her office, it had to be late on that Friday. She calls me early on a Monday morning to tell me, oh, there was only one building and all they did was parachutes. How the hell can she investigate when there's nothing around open on the weekend? So who shut her mouth? I know what went on out there, and so does everybody else in this town. She has the power where she can get to the bottom of it. She ignores it. She could have got so many other people involved, went out there, got things going, and found out within 2 weeks, or even less. But nope, she wasn't running for freeholder, so why bother? If you're running for office and you want the vote, then you're going to do something. But she wasn't running, so why the hell check it out? It's not her life. It's not her family. Why should she care?
Susan Dickey canceled a scheduled interview with us, despite her message that she would get back to us. She never did.
But there's a lot of people around here who still know and remember. It's just to get them to talk. They're afraid. We've been afraid. Because my grandmother, everybody in here, we all have our own wells. And you stop to think about the people who have died, like in 15 years. I can go house by house and go down and tell you who died of what. We're all the way out past the trail court. And this is this whole area. And the people all around here are getting cancer. I just found out two more people in town that have cancer. All different ages. There's a guy who's only like 32 years old. Has a tumor growing out of his chest. He's got like a 2-year-old son. And there's nothing they can do for this kid. And he was born and raised in town. And in fact, he's only maybe 2 blocks away. But it's more and more people getting it. And it, all different kinds of cancers. It's not, if it was just one kind of cancer, but it's not. It's like all different kinds. I'm only 45. And I found out I had cancer when I was 44. Because I basically on the street all my life. Another kid I grew up with lived right across the street. He died of cancer. He was 45 when he died this past September. And they had their own well. And we went out there how many times to that pond and played. We ran out in that swamp all the time and played. And now we're all getting cancer. The kids who grew up with us and moved away from Oxford, they have no problems, neither do their kids. The ones that stayed here, our kids are having problems. We're getting sick. What the hell's going on?
Oxford Textile Company is owned by Mario Guarillo and referred to by residents as the Dye Works. It has operated in Oxford for most of the past century. In general, Dye Works are notorious users of some of the most dangerous industrial chemicals and compounds.
2 big smokestacks. They were huge. And when you could be inside here, and at night and early in the morning, you would hear them letting that stuff out. And if you went out and looked, you could see this stuff just billowing up in the sky. We used to have, there was like 11 kids here. And we used to do the wash at night, hang it on the line, and do loads for in the morning. But it got to the point where you couldn't put the wash out at night because it was filthy when you went out in the morning. There was like stuff all over it. So you either hung it out early in the morning before you went to school or whatever, because when you came home, if you left it at night, it was all filthy dirty. You had to rewash everything. It was like soot or something on it. It was all like with the bed sheets were all white. There was like speckles and spots all over them. And you could smell, like it would burn the inside of your nose. If you went out and you like breathe the air, it would burn your nostrils and down in your throat. And to go play, we were told you never went down there. You stayed out of that area no matter what. But we went down there one day. And you go out in that field, and there's like a little pond. And right in the middle of it is like a fountain. And there's all different colored water coming up from it. And then down, yeah, on the left side, there used to be a dump. And when we could go down playing a dump, you would see this different colored stuff coming down into the dump. And now that's been all plowed and taken out, and there's a road that goes through where the dump used to be. And it used to run in the creek and all this stuff out in the field. You go out there and you'd see this colored stuff. And when we were found out that we were out there playing, we got our butts beat for being out there. And we were told, you were told, don't go there. It's been like that for years and everybody in the area knows it. You'd see a scum out there. And a lot of times too, you smell different odors. Sometimes it would smell like gas. Sometimes it smells like rotten eggs. It's all different odors constantly. A lot of times you ride by and you see this stuff just coming right up out of those fields out there. From the dye works right on past the trailer court. It's like a haze, a weird colored haze. Early in, I was working 6 to 2, 5 to 1. And when I go to work 4:45 in the morning and the sun's coming up, you look over to the left and you'd see like this weird fog coming up out of the area. It was just coming up over above the trees. And they called the DEP in a couple times because everybody out here was complaining about these terrible smells and this weird fog. DEP come in, but they didn't stay long. They checked a couple things out and left. They said, if you continue to smell these smells, call us, we'll come back. We've called, a lot of people have called, they never come back. Because this has been going on for years and years. All these people dying of cancer, these little kids can't breathe. What the hell's going on? But yet they used to have trucks come in with different chemicals from different places and dump it down here. He allowed them to bring these tanker trucks. They're like these big fuel trucks. They would come in and open this stuff up and just dump it out in these damn fields. And they were seen doing it. Now he's got a helicopter pad over top of it. He's got barrels buried out there. But you can't see it because he's got all concreted for his helicopter. And how can he get a private road, public road that used to come from downtown up and around to come up this street? That's all blocked and fenced off. They made two roads, dead-end streets. How can he take that property? Township just go ahead, take it, fence it off. Why? You get caught out there, they shoot at you? What are they trying to hide? You try to go in there and talk to them, they ain't going to answer your questions. It's nobody's business. He's a big businessman in town. He employs people. You leave him alone. Don't ask him no questions. You don't say nothing about nothing. And if you do, watch your back. You walk up and down the street, the different people that have died. People who worked at the dye works have cancer. A man out the road, John Rudy. He worked there for years. He used to go fishing out in his first pond. Eating that fish, working in the dye works, he died of cancer. Everybody out on this street, and it's more and more. I have it, and I'm pissed, because I know what the hell's out in them goddamn fields. And I'm going to raise my kid here and have him raise his kids here? It's time it stopped.
Well, when I used to work there, they had a ditch dug because they had pipes in it. And from there, you know where the dye water went? What the real dye water, black, I'm talking about, black, from the dye house. Just this side of the creek, straight down from here, on this side of the railroad bed, there was a huge pond, huge, but it was had concrete walls around it. And people used to throw their animals, dead animals, in there. Or if they had a lot of cats that didn't want them, they'd throw them in there, and in the dungeon right away, they're dead. And naturally, that must have leaked somehow and got into the creek. How else would it go? You know, we used to swim in that water when we were kids too, in the creek I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. But we didn't know the difference. The water looked all right, but that I don't know where that ever. Whatever happened to that water? Must have went down underground somehow. But now he's got these ponds in the back, and he's got fertilizer. He had a big machine there. I used to watch it from the road, twirling the water around, whatever he's doing, trying to break up the chemicals or whatever, and then put it back into the creek. I imagine that's where, I don't know where else it would go. But then he's got another pond right along the road. You can see that as you're going out to Warren Haven, where the hotel is, well, right here, where the hotel is. There used to be a bridge over the railroad. Well, the railroad's all ripped up now, so there's no more bridge. It's just a little hump. And that pond is right on the left-hand side, black.
We were told by Mario Guarillo's secretary that he would get back to us when he wasn't so busy. He never did.
When we were kids, we went out there and we played in that swamp water. We went fishing in the pond. We went ice skating out there. We've been drinking this water for years, breathing this air. All of us have kids that have problems. So when our kids get older, and if they have kids, what are they going to be passing on to their kids? And before, you never heard of, when we were little kids, we never heard of anybody having cancer in this town. It was rare. Now, all of a sudden, if somebody on the street doesn't have it, something's wrong. But it's like, you know, what's going on? How long is this going to go on? When somebody dies and passes away, the family puts the house up for sale, new people move in, those people end up getting sick. So is it just going to keep going on until there's nobody left? When are they going to start checking things out? I mean, they've known it for how long? I just can't get into my head, even why did I wait so long? Why did I wait so long? I watched my grandmother die of cancer, uncle across the street, the man next door, another friend of mine I grew up with died of cancer, an uncle down the street, and another woman next to him died of cancer. You go out the road, you can trailer after trailer, house after house. You go up this way, down 31, across the highway, house after house. I mean, if I can figure this out, but you have these people who are supposed to went to college and they're educated. This little dummy can figure this out just by looking around. What's wrong with them? What has to fall on their head before they're going to wake up and say, look at this stuff from the incinerator. Look at the stuff coming out of the dye works. Look at the old war site. If I fill a glass with water and I leave it there, say for a day or two, you go back and that's got like a scum or something growing in it. So what the hell's in the water? They won't check it out. I know it's coming from the dye works. It's coming from the old Borset and it's coming from the incinerator. All that stuff is just going right in and we're drinking it, we're bathing it. And we'll say, oh, we're good parents. You know, we're bathing our kids and we're feeding them good. We sure are. We're poisoning them. But we're having a hell of a lot of help. We have the freeholders helping us poison our kids. We have the governments helping us poison our kids. So I have to say, thank you, government. Thank you, freeholders, for poisoning me and my neighbors and my family.
Shut the incinerator. No more dioxin. Shut the incinerator. No more dioxin. Shut the incinerator. No more dioxin. Shut the incinerator. No more dioxin.
The Warren County Incinerator, located in Oxford, New Jersey, has been operating since 1988. It burns 445 tons of garbage a day. every day. In 1978, Frank Leary was appointed to serve on the Warren County Solid Waste Advisory Council. The council's job was to develop a solid waste management plan that would deal with the 200 tons of garbage produced every day in Warren County. He explained the process.
The council deliberated on what to do. We studied the question of incineration. The question arose whether incineration was feasible in an environmentally sound manner. We had the results of several existing waste management, water wall, mass burn incinerators to go on. We determined that it was reasonable considering the airshed in Warren County, and so the decision was made to erect a pyramidal structure of waste management that began with attempting to get people not to generate so much waste in the first place. Reduction, the elimination of the generation of waste, and recycling were the heart of the plan. What couldn't be eliminated, what couldn't be recycled, would be burned where possible, and the residue would be landfilled. That was the procedure.
We asked Frank Leary, why Oxford?
A little mathematical computation determined that the area of Oxford across the county toward Beattystown was what was called the centroid of waste. That is to say, if you weight the generation, the generators of waste and spot them around the county, the place where the county would balance would be in that area. It's not the center of the county, but from the standpoint of the density of the generation of waste, it's the centroid. It would be the place. If you had to apply a value to transporting a pound of waste across the county to some point, the place where all those would zero out would be the centroid. They would cancel each other out. Oxford is close to the centroid of waste of the county.
But Oxford was not the council's first choice. Leary told us that an 80-acre site adjacent to the Ingersoll Rand plant in Phillipsburg was originally chosen as the best site for the incinerator. But Ingersoll Rand, according to Leary, pulled their political strings and the plan was dropped. Oxford, with few voters and the lowest tax base in the county, suddenly became the location of choice. Leary refutes the connection between income and the incinerator.
As a matter of fact, one of the things that the Solid Waste Advisory Council, of which I was the chairman in the 70s and 80s, would tell the representative from Oxford and subsequently from White, which is where the landfill is, that there are provisions in the law that permit you to improve your tax position because of what are called host community fees, and what you all should be doing is getting your logic ready to discuss the question of host community fees with the county when the time comes to site the facility.
Anna Maria Caldera is an activist who has been fighting the Oxford incinerator for the past 11 years. She recalls how local resistance in Oxford was crushed.
And at that time, there was a group called the Oxford White Association that was mostly composed of farmers and people who may have been retired at that time who didn't want this in their community. And unfortunately, when they spoke up against it, they were told that if they didn't keep quiet, that it would be cited on their individual farms. So one by one, these people started to drop out. And with the death of Jim Pepinko's father, they're the farmers that live directly below the incinerator, the Oxford White Association basically disbanded. Oxford seems to have been chosen because the populace there was the most economically disadvantaged. You know, people have personally told me that they were threatened, and so they backed out of their protests against the incinerator.
There is a phenomenon which is sometimes called the banana phenomenon, which is even worse than NIMBY. The banana phenomenon is build absolutely nothing near anybody anywhere. killed absolutely nothing anywhere near anybody. That's banana, right?
The incinerator was eventually built in Oxford, but the burners' appetite for garbage was more than the county could supply. In order to keep the incinerator operating, more than 400 tons of garbage were needed each day. Suddenly, there was a 200-ton-a-day garbage deficit. Frank Leary explains.
No. We're the victims of our own planning. The original research into the generation of waste in the county indicated that we would need something of the order of 600 or 800 tons a day of capacity. As time progressed, it turned out that we probably wouldn't. There were some flaws, obviously, in the research that had been done by Metcalf and Eddy, and we began to realize that it was probably closer to 400. And there was a considerable argument about whether or not we should overdesign in order to make sure that we had enough capacity. And the argument finally was settled in the Solid Waste Advisory Council that we would take the minimum estimate, which was 400 tons a day, and design for that. Now, the design of 400 tons a day means actually 484 tons a day, which is the capacity of the system. Probably is even a little better than that because we've had some efficiencies built into it over the years that were not there when it was built. Mm-hmm. But the 400 tons a day was the design capacity on the basis that that was the best estimate we had of what we were going to be able to handle after we started recycling. Now, recycling worked a little better than everybody thought it might, and the estimates of the generation of waste in the county were a little off, and so the result was that the county does not produce the 400 tons a day that would keep the thing burning at full capacity.
Instead of instituting programs to reduce the amount of waste produced, instead of intensive reuse and recycling efforts, garbage now has to be imported into the county to feed the burner. Now Warren County has the lowest recycling rate in the state. Imported garbage translates into more stack emissions, more ash, larger landfills, and more garbage from uncertain, possibly industrial sources. It was recently disclosed that waste from New York City is being burned in the Oxford incinerator. With the closing of the Great Kills landfill in Staten Island, that trend will likely continue. Anna Maria Caldara.
The danger with incineration is that when relatively harmless materials, that if they were separated, such as your glass, your tin, your aluminum, your compostables, these things that were harmless when separated, when mixed together with plastic, which has a chlorine component in it, suddenly becomes very toxic if it's burned, because burning releases that chlorine atom, and that's a source of dioxin in the environment. And dioxin is the most toxic chemical that is known on the earth, and it bioaccumulates in human fat and in the food chain. So the danger in an area like Warren County is that we're a dairy-producing region, and cows are grazing below the stack. We are collecting this milk. We are not testing it for dioxin. We are sending it throughout the tri-state area, and it's probably loaded with dioxin. I've been calling for the milk to be tested for 11 years because it's a dairy region, and if dioxin was found in the milk, the thinking of the Department of Environmental Protection is that the dairy industry would come to a grinding halt. There's strong evidence that incinerators that operate for certainly as long as ours has been operating, which will be 9 years this year, have shown contamination of milk supplies all around the world. The example that comes to mind right away is Rotterdam, Holland, where about 3 years ago, dairy cows grazing below two incinerators were found to have extremely high levels of dioxin in their milk, and the government decided to subsidize some of these dairy farms and allow the cows still to be milked, and then the milk fat was separated from the milk, sent back to a hazardous waste incinerator, and burned, because the milk fat is where the dioxin is stored. And there was another situation in Germany right about the same time where doctors were advising women not to breastfeed past the age of 4 months for their newborns because the milk was showing such high levels of dioxin. And of course, the highest levels of dioxin, because it's a bioaccumulative poison, are passed directly to the fetus inside the womb, and then, of course, the nursing newborns. Dioxin is a cancer promoter, and it's also an endocrine disruptor. So what that means is that the presence of dioxin in the body can trigger the onset of cancer. And also, endocrine disruption deals with the hormonal messages that are sent throughout the body. And when the hormones are disrupted at such a young age, we're talking about the inability to reproduce, possibly, when these boys and girls grow up, or certainly genetic mutations, or, you know, their own sexual organs not developing in the correct way. You know, people who think they're safe because they don't live near an incinerator are deluding themselves, because airborne travel of dioxin is the major way that it gets from one place to another. That's why we have high dioxin levels at the North Pole in Greenland, where there's no industry, but we have people with high cancer levels, and we have wind patterns that are certainly bringing these dioxins from garbage incinerators in Canada and the U.S. right up to the North Pole. If you live in another region, let's say 100 miles away from Warren County, but you're coming to Warren County to fish in our streams, or you're drinking milk from this area, you're certainly getting a loading of dioxin or mercury. We also have had high mercury testing at the incinerator. So you can't say that you're safe if you don't live directly near an incinerator. You're certainly still getting a certain loading of toxicity, even though you're far away.
I know of no believable test that has indicated any problem with dioxins in the airstream. There has been one comprehensive test run on the facility to determine if any of these dibenzofurans or dibenzodioxins was being produced. And at a measurement threshold down in the parts per trillion, you're getting either none or very few. One part per trillion, depending on which way the wind turns. Yeah. A comprehensive test has got to run more than a grab. You are talking, after all, about an extremely heterogeneous material, which is being subjected to incineration under a variety of different circumstances. Now, first of all, I should point out to you that on the basis of theory, which was the only way we could go before we had the machine, the dibenzofurans and the dioxins break down at around 700 or 800 degrees. They break down into very, very simple chlorinated compounds like hydrogen chloride and carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, and water. We knew that going in, and we knew that the dwell time, combination of dwell time, because this material does not just get flashed, it rides over a variable grill on its way through the fire. It was going to stay at 700 or 800 degrees for a certain length of time. We knew that that was going to break down the dioxins. Furthermore, the material, the airstream keeps being recirculated while it's in that burn chamber, so that the opportunity for it to break down is increased. Now, the question is there a recombination that takes place? recombination takes time. The airstream here is at 700 or 800, probably higher than that, 1200 degrees, and is crashed down. It goes very, very rapidly down, so that there is no opportunity for massive recombination. Mm-hmm. All of which was the reason why we felt confident going in that dioxins were not going to be a problem. The test that was run on the really comprehensive test that was run on the airstream at the time it was accepted indicated that the way it was working was fine. Now, what happens when you start the machine up and it's not working at maximum efficiency, or when you shut it down and it's not working at maximum efficiency, is that there is an excursion.
The incinerator, in my estimation from the beginning, has always... there's always been just one solution to the problems that it creates, and that's to close it, to shut it down, so that it cannot pollute the region anymore, or the people, animals, and plants that live in the region, and so that economically the county is not burdened with this huge debt, and so that the resources that we discard become what they really are again, resources, and they're not just thrown away, they're not just burned or landfilled. Well, naturally, Ogden Martin, the company that owns the plant, along with the PCFA and the freeholders who are all committed to keeping the incinerator alive, do not want to see this incinerator shut down. Ogden Martin has basically been guaranteed a profit. They want to see it. They want to see their profit. They have all our officials in the palm of their hands. We have no officials here with courage who are willing to stand up to Ogden Martin and say we don't want this in our community, even though we have two children who live directly below the plant, who are ages 4 and 3 and who have high levels of cadmium in their blood.
We asked Freeholder Director Ann Stone for an interview. She said she would get back to us. She never did.
All of these officials want to see this incinerator keep operating. The populace, on the other hand, and the activists who have been fighting this realize that the only chance we have of ever reclaiming the health of the region and our own health is to shut the incinerator down. And in communities where this has happened, and this is certainly no oddity, this is happening all across the U.S., deals are made with the banks that hold the bonds, and for example, in Glen Cove, Long Island, there was a $22 million debt, and the company settled for $6 million, and it took the contract for the recycling for the next few decades, and they were guaranteed about $900,000 a year just going on the small amount of recycling that is going on now. With the fact that the incinerator has been dismantled up there, they can increase that amount of recycling a great deal and can therefore increase their revenue. So there are creative ways out of this. But when you don't have officials who are willing to think in creative terms but are just willing to keep the garbage machine going, then you have very little chance of ever seeing the day when this will close through official avenues. People are absolutely being poisoned. I mean, we have people on tape that we interviewed 6-7 years ago who noticed, since the incinerator was operating in their vicinity, that their asthma has worsened, their emphysema has worsened, their respiratory ailments have worsened, or they have suddenly been stricken with all of these illnesses when they were healthy people before. When they leave the area, these symptoms are relieved. When they return to the area, they're aggravated again. We have the family that lives directly below the incinerator that has been stricken probably more than any family that I know. The grandmother that lives there is on a breathing machine where she never smoked a day in her life or had any breathing trouble, at all during her life. She developed a very bad cough several years after the incinerator began operating. She was hospitalized for 3 weeks and sent home with a breathing machine. And she was on that breathing machine for a good deal of time, and she still is on it occasionally. Her little grandson, who was a healthy little boy, was stricken with asthma when he was about 7 years old, and he was frequently over there playing outside. The two grandchildren, her son's two children, who are ages 4 and 3, were tested, and high levels of heavy metals were found in their blood. I believe it was lead, cadmium, and mercury, but the cadmium was exceptionally high. And you know, those children have been living there their whole lives. We also had a pig kidney tested, a pig that was born and raised directly below the incinerator, who drank the water from the polluted stream that I was telling you about, who ate corn that was grown directly below the stack its whole life. And when this pig was about 7 years old, it was slaughtered. And we tried to get the liver from the USDA inspector who was on site at the time the pig was butchered, and he would not release it because the liver was covered with white spots. However, he did give the farmer the kidney, and we had the kidney tested and found high cadmium levels. We had a case of a woman who's going blind, and she lived within, I believe, 1,500 feet of the incinerator. And we have statements from her doctor saying that he believes the Warren County incinerator is directly responsible for her eye problems. We have testimony after testimony of people who have told us that they believe their cancers are due to the Warren County incinerator, because there are whole streets where people were healthy up to about 5-6 years ago, and now the whole street, which is in fairly close proximity to the incinerator, has got one form of cancer or another. There was also a little girl, 4 years old, Amanda Ennis, who lived in Mountain Lake, which is only 2-3 miles away from the incinerator, who at 4 years old died of brain cancer.
Producer Bill McLaughlin caught up with Governor Christy Whitman during one of her recent PR jaunts through northwest New Jersey. He asked her about the Oxford incinerator, the cancer rates in Warren County, and about the recent vote by Mercer County freeholders to reject a proposed incinerator on Duck Island near Trenton.
What do you think of the demonstrators outside and their claims about the incinerator causing dioxin?
Oh, I know what their concerns are, but as they know that the incinerator is tested quarterly, has been since 1995, and has been consistently within the range and the limits, and DEP is monitoring the situation very closely.
What about the 700 violations that the incinerator has been fined?
Well, again, a lot of those, when you look at them, are very minor violations. They're not health threats, and they are corrected as soon as they're pointed out. That's one of the problems when you monitor as tightly as we're doing. You find a lot of little things, but the question is whether they're serious health problems.
Are incinerators going to be a part of New Jersey's waste disposal future?
Well, the real problem we have to, until we stop using products, we're going to have to figure out something to do with them. And as we all know, that just burying them in landfills is not a good way. You're never going to recycle 100%. So until technology finds something new, you will probably have incinerators.
Are you concerned that Warren County has the highest rate of cancer in New Jersey? And do you think that has anything to do with it?
We're doing cancer registry research all over in Ocean Township, which does not have an incinerator, has a very high incidence of cancer.
They have Steve.
But we don't know that it's from that. So we're constantly trying to find what it is. Unfortunately, I think it's our modern way of living that is making it worse.
You have no plans to really close incinerators throughout the state?
No, at this point, we have no plans.
The defeat of the incinerator at Duck Island wasn't a signal to you that people don't want incineration?
I can understand, and I was a freeholder back in the 80s when we had to site an incinerator, and I understand, and I live in this state, and we all want clean air. We have this problem. We have to do something with our waste, and we can't expect people to the west of us to take it forever. And in fact, the government is going to provide them with the ability to stop that very soon. As long as we constantly monitor, and as long as we're careful and honest about that monitoring, it does not pose a health threat, and we just have to, we're learning all the time, though, what's good and what's bad. You know, we got to get everybody to stop smoking. We got to get everybody to do a lot of other things and lifestyle changes to really make us better.
Okay, thank you.
Madeline Hoffman is the New Jersey Green Party's 1997 gubernatorial candidate. She recently announced her intent to run against Governor Whitman in the upcoming November elections. Hoffman participated in an anti-incineration protest
during Whitman's visit to Warren County. We asked her about the governor's responses to our questions.
Governor Whitman is responsible for, or Governor Whitman can do something about the pollution in this state, and she can do something about the Warren County incinerator. We want her to take some action to shut it down because of the pollution that it's causing in this area. And since she decided to visit a dairy farm in Warren County this morning, I think we thought it was more appropriate even for us to talk about the dioxin, the mercury, the cadmium, the other pollutants coming out of the incinerator and possibly affecting the milk from our dairy cows.
I just asked her if incineration is part of New Jersey's future, and she seems to think so if it's monitored properly. I asked her about the 700 violations of the Warren County incinerator, and she says they were very small.
Well, you know, I think big business runs the incinerators. Governor Whitman has made a pledge to be business friendly. Of course, incinerators are a part of New Jersey's future if Governor Whitman is in power, because she wants to be friendly to business. So she's going to say nice things and she's going to downplay their problems. But the people who are affected by the problems from that incinerator are not going to take it so lightly. And the economics of incinerators are dooming them to failure. The environmental problems from incinerators are dooming them to failure, and we won't stop until those five operating incinerators in New Jersey are shut down, including the one out here in Warren County.
Part 3, we'll get an inside look at the Oxford incinerator through the eyes of an ex-employee. We'll also talk to a young couple trying to raise a family within just a few miles of the incinerator.
You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.